I would say one of the things that's happened with the Mass is that the Mass has been turned into the be-all and end-all, the only thing that Catholics do ever together. You know, if they're going to have a parish picnic, oh, we got to start with a Mass, you know, under the tent, and, you know, it's, and next to the hot dogs and hamburgers, you know, it's the only, it's almost like Catholics can't think of anything else to do together except that. And that's a problem, because we have the Divine Office to pray together. We could have a scripture study group together, which would be a great, a better way to get to know scripture than reading this unwieldy, gigantic 2-3 year lectionary. You know, we could go to confession and make a serious use of that. You know, we could pray the rosary and meditate on the mysteries. So there's this, you know what I'm saying? There's this complex ecosystem of ways that we're supposed to relate to each other and to God. And the Mass is a very, I would describe the Mass as being like the peak, the summit of a mountain, where it's lofty. It's a lofty peak. The air is a bit thin. It's a bit chilly up there, but you can see, you know, for miles in every direction. It's the most magnificent view, but it's a narrow peak, you know, that's built on the rest of our devotional and sacramental life.
Right? Yeah. Elsewhere in the book, you refer to it as steep, craggy, and sublime. I wrote that down. Yeah. I thought that this is in your answer to Father Longenecker.
So that's my thought, is that if people can learn, and I think the traditional Mass teaches us this without even very much difficulty. We don't even have to try hard if we just are patient with it and let it form us, be passive to it. Receptivity is not a bad thing. But if we let it form us, we'll come to appreciate the Mass as like, it's like a laser beam of a prayer. You know, it's not supposed to be this kind of watercolor wash that is somehow everything and nothing. You know, it's very specific, and it should do exactly what it's supposed to do. And when it does that well, it opens up worlds, spiritually speaking. So it's like entering through the narrow door.
Yeah.
And then once you enter through that narrow door, you're in this lush garden, right, that spreads out in all different directions, but you had to get there through the narrow door.
Yeah. Well, you're talking about that you made an ecological comparison for the Mass. We're getting into a little bit of an agricultural thing here at St. Benedict Center for necessary reasons, but as we do so, we're applying some of the principles of what's called permaculture. And permaculture is sort of getting away from the monoculture way that they do farming now, sort of the Monsanto approach. You just drench this field in chemicals and then grow one crop on it and ruin the soil and all that stuff. Whereas there's a much richer approach to the whole permaculture thing, where you're using nature's natural symbioses, where different plants and animals sort of help each other out. Well, it's interesting, because as soon as you brought up the ecological comparison, I thought of some things that you said in the book about the different ways of participating in the Mass. And I also thought back to horrible days when I was in school, in a Catholic school, and when our religion teacher, a former nun, was basically screaming at us all to participate by singing these garbage glory and praise tunes, and none of which enthused us at all. The idea is that everybody had to do the same dang thing. Yeah, everybody was expected to do. You were all part of this thing, and the actual or active participation was we had to sing these garbage songs. The idea that you could be at, that nobody would have thought that you could kneel silently and benefit from what's going on at the altar. What the priest did and the way he went about it didn't look like the kind of thing that you could kneel in silence and benefit from. He didn't convey
You're talking about in the Novus Ordo.
Yes.
Yeah. No, it's terrible. You can't do that. I mean, you can't kneel and silently contemplate what goes on at a lot of English masses. I mean, it's just not something you can meditate with. Well, yeah, let me just make a point based on what you were saying. The spiritual life, the interior life is difficult. I mean, it's not difficult in the sense that it's only for a privileged few. It's for everyone. And God offers everyone the grace to develop a life of charity and a life of prayer. But it's still difficult for us, for our fallen, sensual human nature with disordered concupiscence, with distractions from work, from family life, you know, from the world, from politics, from COVID-19, whatever it is. It's difficult to concentrate. It's difficult to recollect ourselves, to gather ourselves in to the interior castle and actually come you know, into communion with the divine, with the Holy Trinity. That's very difficult for us to do. And so one of the great helps that the church traditionally gave us is a liturgy that was very sort of unbending and in a certain sense unyielding. It was almost always the same. Obviously, there were all kinds of beautiful, subtle differences from week to week or from season to season. But fundamentally, the traditional Latin Mass, it's like it's monolithic in a certain sense. It's this beautifully polished, organically developed structure of prayer that is totally solid and reliable. It's like a structure you can climb on and you can beat it up and it'll never break. You can do anything to it. It's unbreakable, right? And so it can sustain you in your prayer, and it teaches you how to pray. And it teaches you how to pray with the patience of a teacher who never gets upset with you and who doesn't like fly off the handle and change her method every other week or whatever. It's the method is always the same. So what I find is that I've been going to the traditional Mass for many years, and there were things about it that didn't make sense to me, but one day, after months or years or something, something would click, and suddenly, like a window or a door would open, and I would say, oh, that's it. I just saw something about God or about myself or about some other mystery that I've never seen before. But I was able to do that because I'd been confronted with it so many times.
Yes, yes.
and it's like my soul was finally able to catch up with the thing that was always there and had been there for, you know, 1,000 years or 2,000 years or something of church history. And so there's something very stable, it's a very solid wooden ladder, you know, on which you can climb.
And for all of its stability, it doesn't cram you into a uniformity with everybody else around you.
Hence the diverse
ecosystem.
Right. And so there's a paradox here, and there always is. When you start talking about, you know, the traditional liturgy, you find all kinds of paradoxes, which are wonderful. But the paradox is that the liturgy, the old liturgy, is so firmly and stably and solidly what it is, that it facilitates many, many different ways of entering into it. It's not a one-size-fits-all enterprise.
Yeah, so the actual participation, participatio actuosa, that was mentioned by Pope St. Pius X, November 22nd, Feast of St. Cecilia, 1903, a work he wrote in Italian, Tra le sollecitudini, where he talks about participatio actuosa, which is mistranslated into active participation. So this is a problem. I knew a priest who was our chaplain for years who pointed out to me that was mistranslated. It's not active participation, it's actual participation. And you point out in your book that by it he meant entering into the divine worship that's taking place on the altar. It had nothing, he wasn't saying you have to be part of some dialogue with the priest, or you have to sing, or you have to worship by saying the responses like the altar boy does. He was talking about with the mind and the soul and the heart entering into the mystery of divine worship taking place on the altar. So
right.
You go into this at great length in the book, but you also point out, yeah, there are so many different and divergent ways of participating, but that it's not, you know, one of the attacks on the traditional Mass is, well, the traditional Mass is something that happens over there. You know, here are the lay people over here, and the Mass is something that happens over there. And again, it goes to that idea of it's a spectator thing and you're a distant spectator. But you point out, I think very eloquently, that that's not the case. And I should say that in your apologetics, I mean, if somebody says, well, I don't need to read that, I'm already convinced, it's not a matter of just the apologetics for somebody who's unconvinced. It's also that it'll help you, as it helped me in reading these passages, to grow in a deeper appreciation of what we have, of the treasures that we actually have. But so somebody can actually participate in a variety of ways in the traditional Mass, but it begins with what makes us human, you know, intellect and will. It engages the intellect and the will.
And this point, you're kind of bringing up a point from chapter 3 about the distance. There's a deliberate cultivation of distance in the traditional liturgy between the congregation in the nave and the clergy in the sanctuary. But it's not for the sake of leaving them distant, right? Of saying goodbye, you know, like sending them into outer space, you know, because they're not relevant. It's essential for creating the atmosphere of the sacred and of mystery. That is, if we just saunter right into a church and we just go right up around the altar and hold hands and say the Our Father and pass around the cup and all this kind of stuff that was happening in the 70s and still in some places happens, although not very often anymore. If we do all of that, whatever else is going on, it's not mysterious, it's not sacred, it's not divine, it's not transcendent, it's not, you know, it's not what Christians have always held the liturgical mysteries to be about. So the Mass actually has a kind of wise pedagogy for leading us into the presence of God in such a way that we understand him to be deserving of reverence and fear, but also then to be in a position where we can actually cry out to him and ask for his help because we know we need it. You know, we have to be reminded of who and what we are first. And in order to overcome the gap, so basically what I'm saying is, if people don't know that there's distance between us and God, they're never going to turn to him in contrition and in petition and ask for the grace to be united to him, right? It's like if you don't even know that God exists, then what's, you know, what kind of faith life can you have? And similarly, if you don't have a proper conception of the awe that one should have in the presence of God, then the rest of religion is vain at that point, because you're not dealing anymore with the true God. You're dealing with some kind of like teddy bear God or some kind of fiction of the human mind, right, that we make up.